I think the strategic Bitcoin reserves, they are important in that it goes and shows a wide acceptance that Bitcoin is a legitimate thing and the tech legitimately works. But, you know, there's two sides of this. One is legitimate in the sense as we're going to allow it to be a thing. We value it. We recognize why other people value it. And then the other part of it being we recognize that the technology actually works well enough. It's going to keep working in maybe another 10 years. Now, of course, I might be the sort of person who will give you, you know, five reasons why, well, maybe it's not going to work so well in 30 years, but it's certainly not so busted that it's likely to fail in, you know, 5-10 years. Now, a counterexample to that is imagine you had created Bitcoin back in the 90s, when very early into cryptography. You could have made the plausible argument in the 90s, you know what, we're not really sure cryptography works. Like, we're putting all our trust in this Bitcoin thing, you know. But in the 90s, you probably would have picked cryptography algorithms that were broken later. And that could have ended quite badly, depending on how you navigated those breakages. This is also, I got to point out, why it would be very surprising to see governments make, say, a strategic Monero reserve or a strategic Zcash reserve. Those coins have their purpose, but one of the choices they've made is they've vastly increased the technical risk of failure because the privacy tech means you're really relying on the math being correct. In Bitcoin, you're relying on arithmetic being correct. Any smart six-year-old could add up the numbers on a Bitcoin transaction and, like, figure out whether or not it's correct. For a smart six-year-old could do that even without you telling them what it is.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. Bitcoin continues to create new blocks every 10 minutes, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. If you are listening to this right now, remember, you are still early. If you're feeling the urge to support this show with some sats, quick reminder that you can do that on Fountain app by boosting this show or becoming a paid subscriber, or give it a zap on Noster, or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care. This episode was a live stream with the one and only Peter Todd at the Rumble booth in Vegas. The audio is a little bit weird at times, so I do apologize for that, but hopefully you still enjoy the content. Peter and I get into a bunch of different topics, from the HBO documentary where they claimed he was Satoshi Nakamoto, to what he's working on with open timestamps, to his thoughts on tail emissions. Shout out to Peter. This was a very impromptu rip, and I appreciate him sharing his scarce time with me. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Peter Todd.
Greetings and salutations. I am Walker. I am joined here by Craig Wright, I believe. Someone who is not Satoshi Nakamoto is all I know. Peter Todd, star of the hit HBO hit piece about Bitcoin. Peter, thank you for joining me. I was a little bit hungover this morning, and I don't want to blame you, but you were there, and so I'm gonna blame
hey,
you.
I didn't stop you. You know, I believe in freedom.
You may have been that you do. So, you know, Peter, I always enjoy talking to you. As we were saying before this, like, I never know if I'm being trolled by you. I don't think the HBO guys knew that you were trolling them. At what point in that whole process did you realize, like, these guys are trying to make this into a story that's gonna make my life a pain in the ass?
Well, so my theory on this is I suspect that they set out to film a documentary on the rise of Bitcoin. And they probably filmed, you know, 5,000 hours of footage.
Did you say 5,000?
Yeah, that's kind of a normal number for...
That's mind-blowing.
Obviously, you have not done video production.
I'm a novice at this, you know?
No, it is like... Like, you know, even just with me, they just film hours and hours and hours of interviews, talking about all kinds of different things, talking about the same thing over and over again. And, you know, this seemed totally normal to me. But it was only at the very end, the last interview, towards the end of the last interview, then they finally bring up the Satoshi stuff. And my suspicion is, of course, they filmed all this footage, started trying to edit it, realized it sucked, and then added the Satoshi thing last minute. Samson Mao claims otherwise, but it's just not the impression I got from them. And also, this is why I am not sure, like, I should say, I suspect that they fully understood they were being trolled. Because remember, they're entertainers. They're not quote unquote documentary filmmakers, even though technically, yeah, or maybe they are, but their job is entertainment. And if they go see someone trolling them, they're probably thinking, all right, how are we going to turn this into entertaining footage? And the answer to that is often, yeah, there's a way.
And I mean, I've got to say, it was pretty cool to like, I watched it as soon as it came out. You made me laugh countless times throughout it. And I realized too, I was like, okay, this is going to make Peter's life a pain in the ass, probably.
Mildly annoying.
Yeah. But like, at the same time, it was like, okay, this was on the front page of, you know, HBO. Like, this was really widely publicized. It got a ton of publicity.
I was told that it was, I think it was on the order, like, their most popular thing in the documentary category. Wow. For, you know, 2 or 3 days. And overall, something like, say, third most total views for a brief period. Obviously, you know, I'm going to go lose in the long run to Game of Thrones, but...
I mean, that's a hard one to measure.
Yeah, that's a little hard, you know. But,
I mean, like, that's kind of incredible. Do you think this was ultimately a beneficial thing? Like, was this good for Bitcoin? Like, it probably was not.
Well, for Bitcoin, yeah. I think it's good for Bitcoin.
Okay.
And this is one of the reasons why, you know, when they brought up, I mean, Chris, one way I could approach this is, you know, they bring it up and I just immediately go shut it down, right? Yeah. Like, that's a way I could have handled it. But I thought it would be much more valuable to play along with it, to control it, hoping that they would take the bait. Although, like I say, I don't think, like, you know, they're smart people. They know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, when they say they believe this, I don't believe it for 1 second. You know, he's smart enough to know fully well he's playing a role too. And the good thing about it, though, is it gets all this press, and then the press consistently say, well, obviously this is nonsense. And my hope is that the next round of director, when he goes to, you know, HBO 2.0 or whatever it works out to be, they're going to go, I hate to say this, but the other guy already did it better than you. And it's just not going to, you know, the magic's gone. It ain't going to happen again. We're not going to do another Soshi documentary. Now, I've heard there is actually one that's happened, but it sounds like it got way less press.
Really interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to watch this because it's like this, I mean, you've been involved in Bitcoin. Well, if you listen to the documentary, you know.
Yeah. You were, 2008, yeah, obviously. Yeah.
But I mean, you've been involved in developing Bitcoin for a very, very long time. One of the original folks there. Is it kind of wild to see this? I mean, could you ever have imagined at that point when you're like in these rooms, you know, like some of the footage that they had, the old footage was pretty cool. Like, you guys are just hacking away in these, you know, back rooms together. Could you ever have imagined that you'd be like,
oh, easily. No, easily.
So you did.
Yeah. No, this, I mean, obviously, it may not be the highest probability outcome, right, but quite famous. Like, I think it was Hal Finney, as an example, correctly estimated Bitcoin price within, I don't know, an order of magnitude or two now, purely by going, well, all right, how big could it get? Right? What's the size of the world economy? You know, what percentage of stuff could be in Bitcoin? Like, let's look at gold. Like, these are all predictable things.
Yeah.
You just got to sit down there with some numbers and make some reasonable estimations. This is also why I will, in sort of the counterpoint, say, well, obviously Bitcoin isn't actually going to the moon because the world economy is not big enough to get that much more growth. You know, will Bitcoin add another zero to the price? Plausible. Will Bitcoin add another zero on top of that? Plausible. But will Bitcoin add 5 more zeros? Only if you're measuring in US dollars, not real value.
Right.
Like, the value of Bitcoin in terms of Big Macs, unless McDonald's has some amazing improvements in efficiency, it's not going to go up that much because the entire world economy just isn't that big.
I mean, that's an interesting perspective to take. It's like, we have this fiat measuring stick, which is inherently flawed. And I mean, at a certain, okay, I want to ask you something.
Well, this is why the McDonald's, like, Big Mac index exists.
Right.
Precisely because McDonald's is really standardized, and that's actually a reasonable way to measure different economies.
And it turns out that dollars they can print out of thin air, or not even print, just keystrokes, are not. Like, do you subscribe to the, like, this hyper-Bitcoinization idea that at a certain point, it's like, it is ubiquitous, it is the only money? I mean, do you think fiat goes away, or do you think we're always saddled with
fiat?
Well,
I will say that is a possible outcome.
Okay.
It is clearly a possible outcome. It is not guaranteed. And I don't think the incentives guarantee that happening. And one reason why I would say that is, of course, we didn't wind up with that happening with gold. Now, maybe the tech is different. Maybe the fact you can easily send a Bitcoin over the internet is enough to make it be hyper-Bitcoinization rather than hyper-goldization. But it's not clear how it turns out. The other thing I think Bitcoiners underestimate is governments aren't that incompetent. Like, we all want to believe they're all incompetent. But like or not, you know, the U.S. dollar, as an example, has existed for a very long time. And obviously, they're doing something right enough that it will, that, you know, easy 50-50 chance it exists in another 100 years.
Do you, do you enjoy the fact, or do you, what do you think about the fact that governments are now potentially stacking Bitcoin? Like, was this also just inevitable?
Well, you realize that's actually a sign of governments being competent.
Okay, touche. So they're not as dumb as they look.
Yeah, they're not as dumb as they look. Like, now, I got to make the point that, for instance, for the U.S. government, they have enough debts in a big enough economy, a diversified enough economy. If they started really aggressively stacking Bitcoin, you'd kind of wonder what's really going on, because the U.S. government can borrow money on reasonable terms. So, you know, I mean, let's look at, say, the Strategic Oil Reserve. That is a physical asset that you absolutely need. If you don't have it, really bad stuff happens really quickly. Like, it makes sense to have a strategic reserve of oil because it's a useful thing. Does that logic really apply to Bitcoin that well? Sort of, but it's not in the same category. I mean, it's not unlike having a strategic gold reserve. That, yeah, it kind of helps in certain cases, but you ain't going to eat your gold.
Would it impose any sort of additional accountability on government, or would it just allow them perhaps to be even less accountable? Because
if Bitcoin goes up and up, exactly. Yeah, less accountable. I believe Bhutan is an example of this, yeah, where they famously started mining kind of in secret.
Yeah.
We find out a few years into this, oh, actually, they've got a bunch of Bitcoin. And from what I've heard, they started spending it.
Okay.
The knowledge kind of filters out, political pressures on them to do something with the money.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to make the claim that for sure they're spending it recklessly, but it sounds like maybe that's what's happening.
It's interesting. Okay. So this has been like a very big topic of conversation with the strategic reserves and everything. I'm asking you about it, but I'm also curious, like, is this kind of do you view this as a distraction from other things that are far more important happening in Bitcoin right now? Or is this actually, is it correct that this should be the hot topic of every conversation?
If you're stuck spending dollars, at least stop earning dirty fiat rewards. Use Fold to earn Bitcoin on everyday purchases and regular expenses, like groceries, bills, travel, home improvement. I literally just earned 2,203 sats buying a $100 Amazon gift card on Fold. You don't even need to use the Fold card itself if you don't want to. You can connect your favorite credit card and double dip with Bitcoin rewards on merchant offers. Or go all in. Make Fold the center of your personal finances. Buy, earn, save, and even get paid in Bitcoin with Fold. Head to the link in the show notes to get started with the ultimate savings toolkit. Or go directly to use.foldapp.com/r/walker and get yourself $10 in Bitcoin when you sign up. If you've accepted that we're living through the fourth turning, then it's time to get yourself some Bitcoin and then go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the easy-to-use, fully open-source, Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own self-custody and prepare yourself for the chaos that is to come. The world is going pretty wild right now, but Bitcoin is ripping, and your stack will soon be worth a heck of a lot more in fiat value than it is today as every currency around the world hyperinflates. So now is the perfect time to get your security locked down tight with Bitbox. I really want to emphasize that the Bitbox O2 is easy as hell to use, whether you're brand new to Bitcoin, it's your first time setting up a hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath. It is Bitcoin only and fully open source. No need to trust me. You can head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this podcast. So thank you. Let's talk about using Bitcoin the way it's meant to be used. Self-custodial, lightning fast, and ready for the real world. That's exactly what BitKit Wallet is all about. BitKit Wallet is a clean, powerful Bitcoin and Lightning mobile wallet that gives you full control on-chain and on Lightning. You hold the keys always. Whether you're brand new or are a seasoned Bitcoiner, BitKit's intuitive wallet design makes it simple to send, receive, and manage your sats. QuickPay lets you fire off Lightning payments faster than ever, and seamless integration between on-chain and Lightning means your funds are always where you need them. It's your daily driver Bitcoin and Lightning wallet, and it actually feels good to use it. And with modular widgets, you can personalize your experience to match your style. There's even a Lightning node running right on your phone. No custodians, no compromises. Go to bitkit.to or search BitKit Wallet in your app store and start using Bitcoin like it's meant to be used. That's BITKIT.to.
I think the strategic Bitcoin reserves, they are important in that it goes and shows a wide acceptance that Bitcoin is a legitimate thing and the tech legitimately works. So, you know, there's two sides of this. One is legitimate in the sense as we're going to allow it to be a thing.
Yeah.
We value it. We recognize why other people value it. And then the other part of it being we recognize that the technology actually works well enough. It's going to keep working in maybe another 10 years. Now, of course, I might be the sort of person who will give you, you know, five reasons why, well, maybe it's not going to work so well in 30 years. But it's certainly not so busted that it's likely to fail in, you know, 5-10 years. Now, a counterexample of that is imagine you had created Bitcoin back in the 90s, when very early into cryptography. You could have made the plausible argument in the 90s, you know what, we're not really sure cryptography works. Like, we're putting all our trust in this Bitcoin thing, you know. But in the 90s, you probably would have picked cryptography algorithms that were broken later. And that could have ended quite badly, depending on how you navigated those breakages. This is also, I got to point out, why it would be very surprising to see governments make, say, a strategic Monero reserve or a strategic Zcash reserve. You know, those coins have their purpose, but one of the choices they've made is they've vastly increased the technical risk of failure because the privacy tech means you're really relying on the math being correct. In Bitcoin, you're relying on arithmetic being correct. You know, any smart 6-year-old could add up the numbers on a Bitcoin transaction and like figure out whether or not it's correct. A smart 6-year-old could do that even without you telling them what it is. Like,
well, okay, let me ask you something. Speaking of, let's say, potential technical issues or technical complexity, you have perhaps been, you're often a controversial figure, let's say. Again, never sure when you're trolling and when you're not. You have thrown things out there like, hey, Bitcoin may need tail emissions at some point. Is that a troll or do you actually know?
That one's not a troll.
Explain that.
Well, so there's a couple issues there. First and foremost, obviously, there needs to be an incentive for miners. If there's not an incentive for miners, clearly Bitcoin doesn't work because the proof of work drops to the point where it's just broken. And some asshole will go 51-cent jacket. So we can certainly say that's true. But the more subtle technical point is not only do we want there to be incentive for miners in general, we want there to be a consistent incentive. We always want miners to want to make the next block. Now, they should be getting paid to do that, and that should be how they earn the most money. So ask the question, if transaction fees are the only way that miners get paid, why exactly should they make a new block rather than maybe remine the previous block? And it's very easy with only transaction fees for these incentives not to work.
Well, okay. And I hear that point. But isn't it, if we're talking about this fiat measuring stick, you know, that is inherently unreliable, as we get into the future, it's like, okay, yeah, there's no more block reward. But aren't these transaction fees going to be like, are we measuring them wrong right now?
Well,
to think this isn't sustainable?
The problem is, even if transaction fees overall create an on average mining reward, there's no way to make them have a completely consistent mining reward. And inevitably, fee is coming, you know, coming bursts. That's just, well, because blocks themselves are founded first, fees then come in bursts as well. Because if a block takes a while to be found, fees naturally go up as people outbid each other, try to get into the next block. So this is just one of those things that happens. But of course, if that happens, now fees are very high. Now the incentive is for a large miner to try their hand at mining two blocks in a row and sweeping up those transaction fees. And this, you know, this is just a fundamental issue. And the way you solve that, or at least try to mitigate it, is by always having a big enough reward that fees aren't that important. And this is why we haven't seen this in Bitcoin, because the times when fees are higher than reward are very rare. Even with inscriptions and so on, it was still a very rare thing. Yeah. In the future, that will not be the case. And all our mathematical modeling of how incentives work indicates that at that point, Bitcoin's consensus starts to become unstable. Now, that by itself would be okay, except that only large miners can profit off this. You know, if you have a BitAx, you find a block, the chances of you finding another block are so low, you put all your hopes in one block. If you're Antpool, you have enough hash power, you have a reasonable chance finding two blocks in a row. Thus, a reorg makes sense. But of course, if they do a reorg, your block got reorged out and you just lost, you know, $1 million.
I mean, and I hear that, but my worry is, don't you think this kind of like a tail emission proposal, doesn't that undercut the actual, like, the credibility?
Well, so tail emission specifically, that's a fascinating proposal. And of course, Monero does this. It's fascinating because the rate of new coin supply actually converges towards a rate at which coins are lost, or, you know, lost or destroyed. And this comes down to basically how the math of this works. So the analogy I like to use is, like, imagine a leaky bucket. All right. You have a bucket. Water's coming into the bucket at a fixed rate, and there's a hole at the bottom of the bucket. The amount of water coming out of that hole is proportional to the depth of water in the bucket. So there will always be a depth where it converges. If the depth is really low, not much water comes out, more water fills up. The depth is very high, more water gets forced out. If it goes down. So there's a fixed level.
A natural equilibrium, basically, because people do lose coins.
They will always lose coins. And also, for other reasons, coins will naturally get destroyed too. But mostly it's loss. Like, there's just no avoiding it. People will lose coins. How, you know, what percentage per year? Probably on the order of 0.1-ish%, maybe 1%, maybe. So probably somewhere in that region. So if you have a tail emission that starts off at something like that, what actually happens effectively is that the value increase that you would have otherwise gotten by other people losing their coins gets effectively diverted to miners to pay for the security of your own system. Now, I'm not making the claim that amount of money is guaranteed to make Bitcoin work. I'm just saying that's an amount of money that clearly we can afford because people don't protect their coins well enough to not lose their money. So, like, obviously this is amount of money low enough, really, who cares? And the other argument I was make is, like, let's suppose we're talking about numbers like 0.1%. 0.1% compounded over your entire lifetime. I forget the number off the top of my head, but something like 20%. You can do it on your calculator, right?
I believe you're messing with
me. That ain't mental math. I can know how to, you know, multiply that means in a row. But the point is, it's a small percentage of your total wealth. And the argument there is, if you can't dedicate that amount of your entire savings over your entire lifetime to keeping those same savings secure, what are you doing? Like, this doesn't make any economic sense. You can afford this. Equally.
But can Bitcoin as a network afford it when it comes to, like,
well,
in my mind, that just undercuts credibility.
Right? Does it undercut credibility? Because idiots who don't understand how this stuff works go on podcasts and go yammer on about how terrible tail emission is.
But most of us are idiots.
Well, be better.
I know. We should be. That's why I'm talking to you. Okay, let me ask another question. There's a lot of debate around all this, spamming, fix the filters, all these things. I don't actually know where you stand on that. Do you think this is a, like, is this an argument that is actually matters and need to be had, or is this something that just sorts itself out?
Well, the way I would put it is, we know there is no principled way to stop people putting data in the Bitcoin chain. And furthermore, there's no principled way to stop people from using Bitcoin in ways we don't consider are real. And notably, Luke Jr., back in the day, he wasn't just trying to censor quote-unquote spam transactions that, you know, had data in them. He was actually trying to censor quote-unquote spam transactions that were actual monetary transactions. Satoshi Dice being your example. Okay. So maybe you're too young for this.
I am, but I have read about
yeah.
this.
So back in the day, there was this thing called Satoshi Dice where you'd send them Bitcoin on a particular address. I mean, actually a bunch of addresses with different betting odds. And they'd do the math on whether you won or lost. They actually did it in a trust, you know, in a provable way, which was nice. And then if you win, they send you back your winnings. If you lose, they send you back a small amount of money just to let you know that they processed the bets and you lost.
Okay.
So that is a financial transaction. You're making a bet. You win or lose. If you win, you get your money back.
No data was
no
otherwise.
No data whatsoever. Other than maybe the data in the sense of you did a financial transaction.
It's still data, yeah. But yeah, there were no monkey
in the
loop,
you know, in the sort of inscription sense, there's certainly no data in there. So for a while, this became so popular that, like, you know, over half of all Bitcoin transactions were Satoshi Dice.
I didn't know it was that
incredibly popular.
Wow.
I mean, you know, we're in Vegas right now. Like, there's a lot of degenerate gamblers out there.
There's a lot.
Yeah. And a lot of people looked at this and said, well, obviously, this is stupid. Why are you spending so much money in transaction fees? Why are you using all this precious block space? But of course, at the time, transaction fees were low, so it didn't really matter. And my, you know, my view on it was, well, whatever. People are going to use Bitcoin for what they want to use it for. Like, this is why we have a block size limit. You know, we've decided how much data Bitcoin node needs to process to keep up with the blockchain, and how people choose to use it within that, leave it up to the free market. Luke Jr. already had Bitcoin knots at the time, and he had a blacklist to filter out Satoshi Dice.
Okay.
Yeah, and this was running on Eligius, so Eligius would not mind Satoshi Dice transactions.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you also developed something, Open Timestamps, which is a very different take on how to use the Bitcoin's blockchain for, let's say, non-monetary use. But
very clearly non-monetary.
Very clearly, but in a very optimized way. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it's also how Simple Proof is doing what they're doing, right?
So Open Timestamps, in a nutshell, it's a system to make a math proof that data existed in the past. Why is this useful? Well, bad guys don't have time machines. So if you can prove that something existed prior to when an attack could have happened, you can rule out the attack happening. Now, there's a lot of cases of this. A very clear example, at least for a technical audience, is if you have a digital signature, obviously the private key used to create the digital signature could get compromised. You know, maybe you leave your PHP key on a server. Devs would have done that.
Possibly do
that. Luke Jr. He isn't the only one who screwed this up. It's happened. So Bitcoin Core does have signing of Git commits, and some of the Bitcoin Core contributors use Open Timestamps to prove that their signatures on their Git commits were created prior to when, hopefully never, but if their key does get compromised, hopefully we know when it got compromised and still validate these old signatures. Now, another example, you know, I mean, maybe a broader example is if you're storing data in general for a later, like, archival, why aren't you timestamping? I mean, why wouldn't you want to be able to say, hey, obviously this hasn't been touched for this amount of period of time. Maybe it was, you know, born faked to begin with, but at least it hasn't been faked since. Now, with Simple Proof, they offer this as a commercial service.
Yeah.
And, you know, Open Timestamps, open source software, you have to store this like 1 kilobyte proof file. Not a big deal, but in a lot of use cases, that's annoying enough. You'd rather pay SimpleProof to do it for you. So SimpleProof, among other things, they were hired by the Guatemalan government to do timestamping of election records. Specifically, it's paper ballot system, but obviously the ballots are counted. You get a little sheet with that paper, and that's where the numbers are, you know, however many votes for each candidate. That sheet gets scanned into a database and they timestamped it right then. What does that prove? Well, it proves that at least that claim was created when you expect it to be, which should be roughly an hour after polling. Because, you know, Guatemala isn't some sort of third world country that takes weeks to decide the outcome of their elections. Not that I would know of any.
Like America.
Okay. Oh, so remind me, is that first or third world?
Which is just, sidebar, just patently absurd that we can't seem to figure that out. And like a country like Guatemala can somehow do it in literally
hours. People fail to do something that easy, it might not be because they're dumb. I'll say that much.
Well, that's the sad thing. Cause I remember seeing the documentary and seeing you, like, you know, working on that with them. And that, like, I thought that should have been a way bigger story than it was. Cause I thought that was amazing. Do you think that's something that I know in the U.S., you know, these elections are handled on a local basis in terms of how they handle things. But do you think that's ever something that would actually become widespread in the U.S. or is the intuit?
So in the more recent presidential election in the U.S., one county did, in fact, use open timestamps to help prove the, you know, prove the integrity of their vote. And there's actually one of the guys from SimpleProof, Carlinio, he did an interview with the woman in charge of that. And I got to admit, it's such a hilarious interview in a way because, of course, I know the tech details behind it. And they're going on and on about integrity of elections, how the process worked, and so on. But what it boiled down to is she paid SimpleProof $12 for the service, which is their standard rate for the amount of data they were doing. Then she did all her actual work and sent them 3 emails with the documents that needed to be timestamped, which took all of 30 seconds. Because timestamping is really, really easy. Like I say, if you're archiving data, what's your excuse?
Right.
And in her case, she'd actually gone to the election board and said, you know, here's this thing. Here's why we should do it. It's really dead easy. It's going to cost us $12. You know, we're spending more money on pizza. Like, why aren't we doing this? And furthermore, if you say no, I'm just going to do it anyway because I'm legally responsible for these numbers,
right?
Like, I want one more layer of protection to show that they weren't changed later. And, of course, obviously, this is one of many interlocking checks and balances. Another example being, well, they're legally required to publish the numbers when, you know, once the summary, you know, once the sums come in. Well, of course, how do they do it? Well, like, post on Facebook, post on Twitter. And it sounds kind of silly in a way, but actually, no, like that is a communication mechanism.
Right.
Why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Timestamping it is just one more way of putting in that authentic record saying, yeah, no, it really did happen here. Someone didn't change it later. Because imagine, for instance, if you reported on Facebook and someone changes the figures on Facebook. Facebook's not digitally signed. You're trusting Facebook. Well, if you're able to go show a timestamp, you can at least say, hey, here's my copy. I created this prior to this point in time. Yeah, all right, maybe I created 5 different versions of it. But now you have to make the arguments that why my copy is still invalid too.
Right.
You're in a much better position with a timestamp.
I mean, it seems like, again, one of those things that's so obvious and that it's why wouldn't you do that? Like, unless you...
Well,
unless you don't want
so one of the very first things I added to Open Timestamps was support for Git.
Okay.
And I personally keep all my emails and other datas in Git repositories. You know, every email I have winds up in a Git repository. Well, since I created created the software, it was just dead easy for me to make it possible to just press a button. And my Git repos are timestamps. And every single file in them, I can get timestamps for every single one.
In a kind of this AI future that we're suddenly living in, it feels like that's going to be more important than ever.
Well, I got to say,
like,
one of my biggest regrets with open timestamps was in around, I think, 2017, I downloaded the metadata for the Internet Archive, which is just, it's an enormous amount of data.
How much data was it?
I think terabytes even. It's a certain amount of data. So I go crunch through all this metadata, and the metadata has hashes of their actual data. And I put this all into a big Merkle tree and I timestamp it. And I tried at least to create a system to download more metadata as it came and keep timestamping it. But honestly, the Internet Archive is just so big, I couldn't reasonably do that with the software I had and the budget I had for servers. So I eventually gave up. But in the meantime, the Internet Archive themselves found out about this. And remember, they actually sent me an email saying, wait, you timestamped the Internet Archive? And I explained how it is. Like, but guess you could actually do that. And they invited me to go to San Francisco at their headquarters to go go talk to them. But how would they integrate this into the Internet Archive themselves? Every single person in the room, except one, loved the idea. And that one asshole who came in at the end of the meeting and heard the word Bitcoin just said, well, it's Bitcoin. We're not going to do it.
Seriously.
Yep. We could have had all of the Internet Archive timestamped properly in an easy to prove way prior to AI being a thing. And they fumbled that ball.
That just seems like such a moronic thing.
It really is.
Like this Bitcoin deranged exactly accident, but it's like you're actively shooting yourself in the foot.
It was not technical, shooting humanity in the foot. There was no technical criticism of this. It was purely, we will not advocate for anything involving Bitcoin. It is just fundamentally evil. End of story.
Dear Lord.
Yep.
Do you think they'll ever come around?
Very unlikely.
It's a shame.
Maybe in a few more years, but my contacts there, last I've talked to them, basically say it's the same thing even now. Even as big as Bitcoin's gotten. I hate to say this, but the Internet Archive, it's a bunch of left-wing people, and I don't think they're happy seeing Trump rise in parts on Bitcoin becoming an issue in U.S. politics.
I mean, it's just, like, you're only hurting yourself, though, and that's the sad thing. So,
No one cares what your political views are with Bitcoin. Unfortunately, though, the nature of Bitcoin is only compatible with certain political views, because, like it or not everyone actually likes freedom.
Which is a sad reality to discover. We got to wrap up here in a sec, but I want to ask you, is there something that you're really excited about now or something else that like you're working on? Like, what excites you?
I got to admit,
days?
It's actually still open timestamps. Because so Simple Proof, they've been trying to go and raise funding. They've gotten, I'm not going to get a term right, like I think it's pre-seed round or whatever it is. And they were able to, in turn, give me some funding to go do a bunch more work on open timestamps. Because the protocol, the math behind it, scales. But the software to actually make it scale didn't actually work.
Okay.
Like, it worked, but, if someone tried to make 10,000 timestamp requests per second, it would have just fallen over because they couldn't scale it horizontally. Like, I couldn't throw servers at the problem. So I fixed half of that already, which is to create new timestamps, I can throw servers at the problem. And you just have more and more servers making Merkle trees and so on. Right.
Forest of Merkle trees.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty obvious thing if you understand the cryptography. It's just someone's added, I've got to sit down and write that software. Yeah. So, but then I did, and that's fine. If Microsoft timestamps every single file on every single computer in the world as some new feature, it'll be fine. The catch is the other part of timestamping is to then get the proof back. And that part still doesn't scale. And for technical reasons, that's a lot harder to do, but hopefully I'll be able to, if I don't go to too many conferences, spend the, a couple months worth of work to make all this stuff happen. And then I'll be able to truly say, please timestamp the world's data.
Well, I hope that the world does timestamp its data.
Peter, me too.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
For people that are listening to this, if you haven't checked out Open Timestamps, you should. Go timestamp everything, everything that you
want. It really is as easy as you go to opentimestamps.org, scroll down, there's a button, timestamp your file. It is hashed on your computer. It does not upload to anyone else. Very private. And you'll get back like a little 1 kilobyte file that, 20 years in the future, you can prove you did it right then.
I love it. Peter, thank you so much, man. It's great talking to you. All right.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. Remember to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're watching or listening, and share it with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Find me on Noster at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes to grab sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Bitcoin is scarce, but podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time listening to the Bitcoin Podcast. Until next time, stay free.